thought I was going to get out of this. My name is Ben. I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know what I'm going to do with this one. Somehow I read an article that you're supposed to drink a gallon of water a day, so I've been on that kick. And it's hard, you know. It's a lot of work. You know, if somebody told me I had to drink a gallon of booze a day, I don't think I'd have a hard problem with that. But when it comes to stuff that's good for me, you know, it's kind of difficult. But let's see, my sobriety date is November 3rd, 1994. You know, I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to have been asked to share, you know, hopefully a little my experience, strength, and hope. And, you know, I love young people's meetings. And, you know, I got sober in San Francisco. And we had a young people's group, too, out there. And it was my home group for about 8 years. And, you know, our meeting was an hour and a half. So I guess we were a little sicker. But we needed every minute of that. You know, what happened, what it was like, and what it's like for me today. You know, I can sum it up. You know, 17 years ago, I was in the hospital of an overdose, nearly dead. And today, right before the meeting, I was able to coach my son in the Little League co-championship of his, you know, of his little minor C, which is, you know, coach pitch, T-ball, whatever. Or not T-ball. They get to hit regular. But, you know, and so that's, you know, what happened. And in between... you know, I got sober in San Francisco, and I grew up in San Francisco. And when I got sober, I went to the first time I went to treatment. I went to the counseling room, and the guy Mike Nerona was just a great, you know, the guy was awesome, and you know, he sort of had a sense of humor, and he sat me down, and he looked at me, and he said, "So Bob and Bill are sitting watching the 6:30 news, and Bob turns to Bill and says, there's a guy about to jump off the bridge, and Bill says, I'll bet you $20 he jumps. And Bob goes, okay, you know, I'm good for a bet, puts the $20 down on the table. And sure enough, the guy jumps off the bridge. And Bill looks at the money, and he's looking and goes, you know, I can't take your money, buddy. You know, I have to admit, I saw the 6 o'clock news, I knew he was going to jump. And Bob said, I did too, I just didn't think he was going to do it again. You know, and, you know, if you get that joke, you know, and you truly get it, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, because that's what my using was like. You know, it was this constant just doing the same thing over and over and over again. Like I said, I grew up in San Francisco and, you know, grew up, you know, from a good family. There wasn't, you know, well, as good as I guess can be expected. You know, there wasn't a lot of drama. You know, I went to kindergarten, I guess I was a little slower than the other students, and so they decided to hold me back a year, and so I had to go back to kindergarten for a second year while all my friends went on to first grade. And, you know, I remember that feeling. The reason I share, I don't want to get too deep into, you know, what my mother did and, you know, whatever, but it was the first time in my life that I felt like there was a light bulb that said, something's not right here, you know, something's wrong. And, I didn't like that feeling too much. You know, I didn't like the feeling of feeling different, and why was I held back, and why has everybody moved back? So I decided at a pretty early age, you know, I guess 6 or whatever you are in kindergarten, that I didn't want to feel that way anymore. You know, I didn't like the way that made me feel. And so my first drug of choice, you know, I guess you could say was sort of daydreamer. You know, I was sort of, you know, physically I could be in the room, but mentally I was just like on another planet. And, you know, that's basically what drugs and alcohol did for me. You know, no matter what situation I was in, no matter how awkward I felt, or walking in that situation, as soon as I had a drink, I was good. You know, the voices in the back of the head kind of quieted a little bit, and I felt comfortable. And so daydreaming, you know, I was good. I could be in the room, and, you know, the teacher would be doing 2 plus 2 on the board, and I wasn't getting 4, so I could just go, you know. Anyway, so I took my first drink, you know, I don't know, it was at Molly Guggenheim's party, probably in 6th grade and 7th grade, and, you know, her dad had sort of cleared, it was a dance party or whatever at her house, and her dad had cleared out all the couches and stuff, and, you know, I was there, and I was just like, you know, against the wall, just becoming part, you know, hoping I'd just become part of the wallpaper. I looked over, and my, you know, friend Reed kind of like looked, and there was a bottle of port, like, that he had forgotten to take out of the living room. And so we got into it, you know, and took a sip of it, and, you know, obviously hated the taste. You know, my second sip, I was doing one of these and covering my nose. And a third sip, I wasn't covering my nose. you know, I got pretty drunk. And, you know, but I had a great time. You know, I was talking to girls, I was dancing, and that little voice in the back of my head just wasn't there. You know, that identity or the it or whatever in the back of your head just, you know, back of my head that just tells me I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm ugly or whatever was gone. And I had a blast. You know, ended up throwing up all over the place, and parents had to come pick me up. And, you know, so right off the start, it wasn't good, and saw some consequences. You know, so grew up, you know, continued to do whatever I needed to do at that age. You know, I didn't become, obviously, a, you know, daily drinker at that point. You know, I was in seventh grade. But I, looking back, I remember on the times that I was able to find alcohol, you know, was that much easier for me to live in the world, you know. Went on to college, or went on to high school, and high school was sucked. You know, I found myself a lot easier just to be the screw-up, you know, than actually do the work in school. So, you know, I went to this small high school in San Francisco, which sucked because being from a small school was harder to be ignored. You know, got in a whole lot of trouble there and started, you know, skipping out on classes and skipping out on what I needed to do, and got involved with, you know, some other party favors besides alcohol. And, you know, but one thing that I was able to do in high school, I guess, was I guess somehow I was a good athlete and, you know, excelled in soccer, and I really found, you know, a lot of escape with soccer. Good enough to get me into school, and so I went on to college, and got a scholarship. It was over about 20 minutes outside of San Francisco, and I walked the summer practice, and I went there, and it was the first day of practice, and the coach, you know, had a good practice, I thought, and I was a goalkeeper, so there was only obviously one person that could be on the field at once. The coach pulled me aside. He said, you know, we really like you. We think you're going to be great here, but here's the situation. He said, there's three other goalkeepers ahead of you, and the best one is a sophomore. So the reality of it is you're not going to see any playing time until your senior year. So I looked at him. I stood up. I mean, it wasn't so dramatic, but, you know, basically quit the team after my first day of practice. And I was walking down the street from where the Coliseum was, and there was all these guys like hanging outside this house. And I kind of looked, and it had these, you know, Greek letters on it, and I, you know, knew my brother was at school in Southern California, and had noticed the letters from the fraternity he was in. So I walked in, and the first thing I saw was a guy I went to high school with. And you know, he grabbed me, he brought me up to his room, gave me a shot of tequila and a line of cocaine. And I said, I like college. And, you know, so all on that day, I quit the team and joined a fraternity, you know. You know, the reason I was in the fraternity is because it was the absolute animal house, you know. I mean, it was, you know, it was a mess. And, you know, I was able to use my entrepreneurial skills and realize that, you know, sorority girls and sorority guys really like ecstasy. So, you know, I started dealing ecstasy out of the house. And anyways, you know, the thing is that this disease and wherever, it's like I didn't look at these people or what they were doing or what they believed in or what they stood for or anything. All I saw was they drank and they used like I did. So I was going to hang out with them. Anyways, ended up getting kicked out of there. Which is a very difficult feat, I would think, to get kicked out of the animal house. So at this point, I think it's like my sophomore year in college, and my disease somehow, some way, you know, in my life and everything else in life, I was able to juggle. You know, I was, you know, whether it was a girlfriend, school, family, disease, you know, everything was sort of up in the air with, you know, somewhat minimal consequences. Because I could do whatever I could do to get good grades, to bring home to mom, to say, look, I got good grades. Got caught plagiarizing once. You know, but anyways, you know, to get by, and I was able to juggle all these things in the air. But as this disease, you know, so does as it progresses. And, you know, after time, one ball was able to, you know, be dropped off, and, you know, another one was able to drop off till I was just end with one, you know, and I was just ended up with one, and it was just the addiction and the alcoholism, just juggling. And eventually that came crashing down too, because, you know, one night I had taken too many narcotics mixed with too much other stuff, and, you know, I had an overdose. And, you know, the reason that, by the grace of God, that I'm sitting here now is because I was just happened to be on the phone with somebody when I knocked out, you know, right in the middle of the conversation. And, you know, I was lucky, you know, to be able to, you know, be here today, obviously. But, at that point, you know, I guess my cover was blown, you know, you know, my mom found out, and, you know, all this stuff, and she came to me, and, you know, she presented two options to me. She said, behind door number one is support, love, you know, get you into treatment and be a part of this family, but behind door number two, there's nothing. You know, so being the good alcoholic I am, I chose door number two, because that's where, you know, that's where, you know, everything I needed in order to continue was. So I went to treatment, and that's when I sat down for the first time with Mike. And, you know, Mike looked at me, and, you know, after he was joking around, or not joking around, but telling the jokes, he said, you know, Ben, this is a pretty simple program. All you got to do is change your whole life. And I looked at him like he was speaking French, you know. And right then is when my relapse started. Because I made a conscious decision right there that I wasn't going to do anything they told me to do. And I was just going to get my way through, you know, do my time, so to speak, so I could make my mom happy and, you know, everybody around me happy. And, you know, it's funny, they called me, in rehab, they called me the everything's cool guy. Because we'd be sitting in group and, you know, Jane Doe would share, and I'd tell her what she needed to do and what chapter was in the big book, and, you know, and then John would share, and I'd tell him what he needed to do, and just keep coming back. And, you know, then it got to me, and I'm like, everything's cool. You know, I love sobriety. You know, got out of that, and, you know, did my time. I think it was a 28-day program, and, you know, they said go to meetings, and they said get a sponsor, and they said, you know, all the stuff that, you know, find God. And I went back to Berkeley, and I went back to school, and I went back to, you know, my old life, and I went back to my old friends, and I went back to, you know, old environments and old triggers and, you know, everything that I absolutely was not supposed to do. And, you know, I'd sit there for a while, and I'd be at my friend's house, and, you know, drinking on the water, and everybody else was getting loaded, and I'd go home, and I'd give myself a pat on the back that I made it, you know, and I didn't need AA, and I didn't need what they were all talking about. I was different, you know, and then went back the next night, did it again, and, you know, eventually, come on, I mean, you know, you hang around the barbershop long enough, eventually you're going to get a haircut, you know, and it was just a matter of time, and sure enough, I slipped, and, you know, and what it came to me for a point was, you know, I think I was 21 at the time, you know, for the first time in my life, I needed to make a decision, you know, and it wasn't for anybody else, it wasn't because, you know, I wanted something out of it, you know, it was because, you know, I wanted it, and I was willing to go to whatever length it took. You know, went back to the city and called Mike, the counselor at the treatment center, called my mom and sat him down and, you know, told him that I had relapsed. And, you know, for the first time in my life, you know, I was honest, you know, and got real, and told him that, you know, I wanted to get sober, and, you know, I was willing to do whatever it took, and, you know, was open to suggestions. They told me to go back into treatment, which I did, and then they told me, I was full of willingness, and I was going to do this, and I was going to do whatever it took, and then about day three, I started getting sick, you know, from withdrawals and everything, and, you know, the willingness sort of went away. And, you know, I sort of threw this little, you know, it, for lack of a better word, it was a big bratty fit in the middle of this treatment center, and it was in a hospital. And the orderlies came in, and I started swinging blows, and I had a heating pad because I had jacked on my back in a car accident. It was one of those big medical ones, and I took it and I threw it through the window at the treatment facility, and I said, I'm not going to this halfway house that they had suggested I go to. And I said something that's not too smart to say in a hospital. I didn't say I'm not going to the treatment center or the halfway house. I said I'd rather die than go to the halfway house. immediately the straitjacket went in, the Thorazine went in my ass. And the next thing I know, I woke up and I was drooling out of my face and, doing the Thorazine shuffle. And I was in a, in California, they call it a 5150. I don't know what they call it, a Baker's Act in here, which is a mandatory 72-hour lockup. I guess it was day one where the Thorazine sort of was wearing off. And I walked into the game room, they called it. And I was there, and I was sat on the couch, and, people were playing games and watching TV, and, it was pretty normal. The only problem is there was no games and there was no TV. And it was literally one flew over the cuckoo's nest, man. I mean, it was nuts. And I was sitting there going, and I got it. I got it real clear. It was like, I was still foggy from all the, whatever they'd given me, and but I was clear, and I was clear why I was there, and I was clear that the only difference between those people and me is I wasn't talking out loud. I wasn't playing, but I was absolutely stark raving insane. Called up my, they had a phone there, and I called up my mom, and I'm calling up Mike, and I'm like, get me out of here, whatever you have to do. And of course they didn't, of course they couldn't. But so I had to stay there for another 48 hours or whatever, and thank God I had to do that, So I went to a halfway house after that, and what this halfway house did for me is, it gave me a really strong foundation and accountability, something I never had. When I walked in, they gave me this rule book, and they called it Customs and Courtesies. And this thing was like that thick. And there were some pretty strict rules. At least I thought, when I was reading, I was like, oh my God, are they kidding me? What's this for? What's the, playing, like I knew how to get people sober, and these rules didn't apply to me. They applied to him because he was, worse than I was. And, but looking back on it, all these rules were simple life rules, simple life rules that somewhere in my 21 years, I didn't think I had to follow. Some of the rules were when they asked you to be there on time, be there on time. You have to have a job. You don't drink. You have to go to meetings. Just simple. When group starts, you got to be a group. You miss one thing and you're kicked out of the house. You drink and use, you're kicked out of the house. Really not that difficult. Looking back on it, 17 years later. But when I was in it, I was like, how am I going to not be late to to dinner? And you got three lates in the 6 months you were there, and there were something like 732 things to be late to in the 6 months. And somehow every day I showed up and I made sure I knew where I was going and when I was going to be there, and got through there. I think I got one late, but that wasn't my fault. today it's still ingrained in me. What that house taught me, and but the best thing about that house is, there. And I'll try not to be judgmental here, but I see the thing about that house is that it was AA based, and it was 12-step based, and there wasn't therapy. There was group, but that was just to check in. It was like a house meeting, and you had to go to meetings. You had to go to 5 meetings a week. You had to have a sponsor. By the six months you were there, you had to leave with a sponsor, and had been actively working the steps. And if you didn't do that, guess what? You were accountable, and you faced some punishment at the house, whether it was, having to be in the house and not you know, spending the night out on the weekends when you were late or whatever it was, there were some consequences to not following the rules. You know, the house was very, very much 12-step based, and what it did for me was build a foundation for my sobriety, you know, a foundation that's still there. Just like when you're building a house, the first thing you want is a good foundation for that house. You know, so when the storm comes, and the storm will come, and the storm has come, you know, in my sobriety, I'm able to, you know, still stand. Or actually, you know, sometimes I get knocked down, but still stay sober. You know, it was just really powerful to see. You know, the other thing about it was the men in that house, you know, there was about 45 men in the house, and some of them were court-ordered and getting deferred there by court. Facing their third strike, and in California, Florida is the same thing. It's 25 to life on the third strike. And all they had to do was finish the 12 months, or the 6 months, sorry. It's all they had to do. And I can't tell you how many countless people drank or used and got hauled off to jail, spent 25 years in jail. And it happened 5 or 6 times when I was there. And that's, you know, that's a pretty powerful thing to see, you know, if you're open and willing to be able to take it in and the severity of it. And at that point, you know, during my sobriety, I was, and I really got clear and I got present to how serious this thing is, and you know, what needs to be done in order to stay sober. And you know, I got a sponsor, Dale. And Dale was a cool guy, man. I mean, he's still around, and you know, I still talk to him once in a while. You know, and he just sat me down, and he took me through the first three steps, you know, in a way that took time, but didn't drag it on. You know, I mean, he made me write my first step, and you know, write how my life's powerless and unmanageable around alcohol, and what that means. You know, and then the second step made me write what my understanding of God is, you know, how I grew up, what have I been, you know, tainted with, you know, and it was a big deal for me because, you know, I came in and I used to joke around that not only am I recovering from alcohol and drugs, but I'm also recovering Jew. And, you know, I sort of had this big, you know, X about, you know, AA or about God. And, you know, a lot of that stuff, when I first got sober, the first time was in the treatment center. We had to go to meetings. You know, we got to go on the white bus, and we got to go to meetings. And, you know, I'd sit there in meetings, and all I would hear is God, 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 God. And didn't hear anything else. And, you know, what that was my disease just listening. And when my disease listens, it listens for what it wants to listen for. And it listens for stuff to make me not take in what's being presented or being shared. You know, it's funny, it's like, it's the same, and it happens today a lot. You know, when I want to listen with my disease, I can listen for whatever I want, all right? Like, my mom, you know, if I have this perception of her as being controlling, guess what I'm listening for? I'm listening for her to be controlling. And what she says and what she says, I say, yep, she's controlling. So I went into those first meetings going, it's just a big God, you know, religious cult. So that's where the point that I was listening from. So every time somebody said the word God, I'd say, yep, see, Ben, you're right. So I had to write this, you know, down you know, what my belief in God was, and just clear it out, you know, just have a clearing of it. You know, he told me after I got done with my second step, just start clear, you know. I mean, just believe that I believe. You know, you don't have to call it God, you can call it whatever you want. So for my first 2 years of sobriety, I chose to call my God Chewbacca. You know, I was a little punk, you know, I mean, you know, I used to say it at meetings just to get a little laugh or whatever, but, you know, I called him Chewbacca, and, I got a little timer there, this is better than a gong, So he took me through the steps, you know, we'd go to meetings together, and we'd go to, you know, I'd go to the young people's meeting, you know, and you know, it's so great. It's so great to have young people's meetings, and, you know, without it, I don't know if I'd be here today, you know, because even when I was, you know, coming back, I still had this perception that, you know, sober meant somber, you know, and I was going to live my life with no fun, and this was sort of, you know, a last-ditch effort, and it was the last house on the block, and, you know, what I found is the complete opposite. You know, I went to these young people's meetings, and, you know, it had good sobriety. You know, it was good, you know, people, you know, really lived in the solution and not so much the problem a lot of the times, and had really good sobriety, but most importantly, just as important as that was we had fun. You know, I mean, we laughed. We'd go out after the meeting, and we'd go to International House of Pancakes, and we'd sit there, and we'd drink coffee, and we'd, you know, be loud, obnoxious, and, you know, we were just young people having fun. And, you know, it's funny, because we'd do this every week, and we'd have the same waitress, and she came over to us, and she just said, you know, I got to ask you guys, how do you all know each other? And we kind of, like, looked around, and, you know, there was a black guy, there was a gay guy, there was an older guy, there was a younger guy, you know, and it was just like you look and you're like, okay, wow, you know, we're just a bunch of motley crew here, you know, we're a motley crew here, but, you know, to the outside world, they're like, what are all these people doing, having fun and joking around, because in normal society, you know, it wouldn't be that way, and we just, you know, got a chuckle out of that, because really, if you looked at that as the waitress did, they're like, wow, that's a weird group of people. And they're not drinking, you know? Anyways, I'm going to hurry this along. At about 8 years of sobriety, I met a girl, a woman, I should say. I met a chick. No, but, you know, I fell what I thought was madly in love and decided to pick up my whole life and move to Tampa, Florida, and get married and have a child, and do what I thought was, you know, sort of the natural progression of life and the rite of passages, and didn't work out. But it didn't work out. You know, it's funny because I'd ended relationships before, and it didn't work out because of her. You know, and through the, before we even started the whole divorce, you know, whatever, I was, you know, I called my sponsor out here, and we did a four-step on it. We did a four-step on the relationship, and what I was able to see was the exact nature of my wrongs. And the exact nature of my wrongs is that I'm selfish, self-seeking, and all I care about is myself when I'm not in the program and I'm not working an active program. And so I was able to see my part. And what this program's taught me in every situation in my life is that if I take an honest, seeking look at what's going on, I'm able to see my part in it. And, you know, it's amazing because my ex-wife and I are best friends today, you know. We have a beautiful, beautiful child together. She's remarried. She's happy. You know, I'm on the verge of getting married again. I'm engaged. And, you know, it's just one of those things that nothing happens in God's world by mistake. And it was an opportunity where if I wasn't working a strong enough program and I wasn't in close contact with God, I could have been just like my parents were when they got divorced. And it's like, well, fuck you, well, fuck you, you know, and, you know, I'm going to use my son to get back at you, and, you know, it's ugly, you know, so typical in divorces, but, you know, I was able to clear away all the wreckage of who did what, and who did what to who, and, you know, and just, you know, come to a point where it's not working, let's move on, let's put the past where the past belongs, so we can have a better future, and, you know, today, my life, I mean, I just coached my son's baseball team. And, you know, for me, still looking out, and when he looks at me, and when, you know, when I'm reading or listening to a fifth step by a sponsee, you know, I just almost have to pinch myself. Because it's truly amazing where I am today and where I was, and, you know, who that person was 17 years ago and who that person is today. You know, I'm in a business that is very dysfunctional, And, you know, there's a lot of drugs and alcohol involved in the business I'm in. And, you know, I'm able to not be involved in that. And, you know, I'm in the music business. I go on the road a lot. You know, I'm able to, my partners all know the deal, the bands all know the deal that I'm involved in. And, you know, when I just go and I do what I need to do and I leave. You know, and I don't get involved in all the other nonsense. You know, I have a lot of fun today. You know, it's, like I said, when I first got sober, I thought it was it. You know, I thought it was never going to be fun. I was never going to do anything fun. But, you know, my definition of fun has definitely transformed and changed into something else. You know, I love to travel. I've been to meetings all over the world. I've been to meetings in places that I didn't even speak the language. And yet, I got something out of it. You know, it's amazing how, you know, not speaking a word of Portuguese, I can be in a meeting and know exactly what the people are talking about. You know, it was pretty amazing. It was, you know, because people, you know, when they're talking from the heart and they're being honest about it, you know, you can get that. What else can I tell you? You know, I've been able to, one of the big things for me, you know, was moving here after growing up in California. And it's been, you know, it's been a while. You know, I never pulled a geographic when I was using. I never pulled a geographic when I was sober. And so I've always been sort of in the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area. You know, here I found myself in Tampa, Florida. You know, and it's taken a lot of adjustment getting used to, but the best thing about it is as soon as I moved here, I went to a meeting and I had friends. You know, it was like an instant connection to friends and, you know, to family and to people who, you know, are on the same path as me. 5 minutes? Okay. So when I moved here, you know, it took a big adjustment period for me. What it took was for, you know, another, you know, four step, tenth step, you know, whatever you want to call it, where I had to take a look at my part in it. And guess what my part was? That I decided to move here. You know, nobody held a gun to my head and said, guess what, Ben, I'm going to kill you if you don't come to Tampa, Florida. You know, it was a sober, conscious decision. You know, what I found is this place is good. You know, it's really a good place to live, and it's got good sobriety. And it's got good people, and, you know, I call it home. You know, my family's all from the Bay Area, and I still go out there all the time. And, you know, what I find in my life today is that the more connected I am and the more aware I am, and by the way that I stay aware and live out there where I need to be and not up here is through, you know, working 10, 11, and 12. And when I'm not working 10, 11, and 12 is when I get back into here. And this is a very, like, when I'm in my head, you know, it's a very closed-minded downward spiral for me. You know, every morning when I'm able to look at the day ahead of me, you know, pray for God to help me stay sober and, you know, what I'm going to do today and how am I going to be less selfish. And then at night come back and, you know, review my day and see if I, you know, lived up to those expectations. And, you know, for me, it's just, you know, it's like I said, it's a sense of awareness. It's a sense of openness and living, you know, out there. Because, you know, one thing that I've always realized here is that life, you know, is happening. Life doesn't stop because I, you know, don't decide to work the program that day. Life is still always going by right here, you know. It's just a matter of whether I take the steps and the action to step into life. Again, the way I do that is really 10, 11, 12. I got four sponsees, four and a half. You know, one sort of sometimes disappears a little bit and goes off the grid. You know, what a blessing. You know, what a blessing to be able to carry this message and to be able to, you know, help out another alcoholic. And you know, it's the other day, like 3 weeks ago, I heard was able to read a fifth step or hear a fifth step. And, you know, it's just for somebody to trust in me enough to, you know, open up like that and to be, you know, connected like that is just a blessing of the program. And it had been like 2 years maybe since I had 3 years since I had heard a fifth step. But that connection with a sponsee is just like no other. If you're new and you don't have a sponsor, you know, just get one. You know, I can tell you from my experience, being asked to be a sponsee is an honor. You know, it's truly, you know, I remember coming to the sponsor and my first couple of meetings, and I'd hear Dale share, and I'd go, I want him to be my sponsor. You know, I'd like this guy. And then I'd leave, and I'd give up every excuse in my head why he doesn't want to be my sponsee, or be my sponsor, and I'd leave. And then I go back next week, and you know, the Friday night meeting, I see Dale. Hey, Dale, how you doing? You know, so forth. And so this game went on for like a month. And I'd go back, and I'd share my group at the house about how I found my sponsor. And the counselor would say, well, so have you asked him? And I said, no. So bam, there's a commitment. You know, go ask your sponsor. Go ask Dale to be your sponsor. And there goes accountability. And so now I was committed to do it, and I kind of went up, and I can, you know, I just know, fumbling, you know, all over the place, and I, you know, probably, you know, and then I asked him to be my sponsor, and he said absolutely, positively, I would be honored to be your sponsor. And, you know, it was just one of those things that, again, when I live up here, and I live, you know, it's just the bad decisions are made, the decisions that I almost walked away from. You know, a very good opportunity to ask somebody to be my sponsor because I let my head get in touch with me, you know. You know, so when somebody asked me, you know, and so if you're new and you're, you know, I can't speak for anybody else, but, you know, when you do ask somebody to be your sponsor, you know, despite what your head might tell you, you know, it truly is an honor and a privilege to help out men. And, you know, another thing that, you know, I've really committed my life to, not my life, sounds so dramatic, but, you know, what I'm committed to today, you know, is I really want to help out, you know, alcoholics, and I really want to help out, you know, men in sobriety, and, you know, I've been getting involved, you know, I don't need to talk about that, because that has nothing whatsoever to do with alcoholics. But anyways, you know, I'm just mumbling right now, and I'm going to shut up because it's not going to get anything done right now. So I appreciate it. Thank you very much. It's an honor, and thanks.